How do you do? Mr. Carl Emley feels it would be a little unkind to present this picture without just a word of friendly warning. It is one of the strangest tales ever told. It deals with the two great mysteries of creation, life and death. I think it will thrill you. It may shock you. It might even horrify you. So if any of you feel that you do not care to subject your nerves to such a strain, now is your chance to, well, we've warned you.
Long distance operator, go ahead with your call, sir.
Thank you very much, my dear. Oh, the creatures of the night. What music they make.
Prepare for wizardly combat.
I want to show you a trick Mother showed me when you weren't around.
And I'll not back to a fast step on the field.
Welcome to Spellburn, a podcast covering the Dungeon Crawl Classics role-playing game and old-school adventuring. It's time to party like it's 1974.
Freely and of your own will. This week on Spellburn, we have a special guest just for Thanksgiving. Our summon patron spell went awry and opened up a portal to an alternate universe, a new world of gods and monsters. Tonight, we're interviewing one of our most requested guests, Scott Mathis, the creator and publisher of the latest Dungeon Crawl Classics RPG supplement, Transylvania Adventures. I'm Judge Jim, and with me tonight are my two Dungeon Crawling co-hosts, Judge Job.
Hi, everybody.
Judge Jeffrey.
Hey, everyone.
And our special guest, Scott Mathis.
Hello, everybody.
Welcome to the podcast, sir.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, welcome. Thanks for making the time to be with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
You've been like the number one guy people have been yelling about us having on the show on Google+.
For real?
Yeah.
It comes up a lot.
Oh, that's nice.
Get Scott on the show. Interview Scott.
Oh, awesome.
I mean, you just published the newest, shiniest toy in the DCC universe.
Oh, there's a lot of really cool, shiny toys in the DCC universe. Like Daniel Bishop and I think it was Paul Wolf just did a Prince Charming Reanimator. That thing's pretty cool.
Yeah, we just had Daniel on the show. He's awesome.
Yeah, he is. He's great.
Yeah, that one looks pretty good. I want to check that one out.
If he were playing in your system, his character class would be the Polymath, I bet.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. He was one of the artists for Transylvania Adventures and one of the early supporters. So I'd be interested to find out what his favorite character class was.
Yeah, I was looking at the credits and there was some guy with the same name as Job in there.
Yeah, it was strange. Some guy named Job helped out with some proofreading and editing and gave me some sound advice over at Gen Con.
Okay, well, let's take this to the tavern.
And the first rule of bartending is this. GBTB. Go beyond the book. Go beyond the book.
What do you have?
Heineken! F*** that.
Tavern Talk. Okay, so what did we do in gaming this past week? Scott, would you like to start us off?
Oh, my goodness. I've been super busy at work. So as far as gaming this week, I've just been pretty much playing Sentinels of the Multiverse. We had a Traveler game scheduled, but that kind of fell through. So, yeah, work's kept me real, real busy.
You caught me with my knowledge pants down. I don't know Sentinels of the Universe.
Oh, sorry. Multiverse.
Multiverse.
Multiverse. Yeah, it's just a card game. It's not a role-playing game.
Oh, okay. I'm with you.
Yeah.
Sweet. How about you, Joe?
Well, you know, my game got put off again. I'm going to do my game this Saturday. But so my week in gaming has been lived vicariously through Jeffrey. Well, I had a lot of chores around the house, and I loaded up his actual play podcast. So
I was a little nervous when I saw your comment about the Spellburn Father. I'm like, what's he going to get me on?
What do you have against accountants anyway?
Accountants?
Well, yeah, you know, your group found that book, and then they, you know, it seemed like it was really mysterious and bad. The guy's going to lose 3 points of intelligence when he reads it. And he's like, oh, I got to burn luck, you know. Then he opens it up, and it's a business ledger. He's like, oh, yes.
They knew it was a ledger going into it, so that was their fault.
the sword is this, and, you know, I got to pick up my dry cleaning, and...
It was the business ledger, and they knew it was just the ledger. They decided to try to read it anyways. It was trapped. The wizards like to do that stuff.
The ledger of doom. But so then Jeffrey goes through to play out my worst Craigslist nightmare of all time. His group goes through the ledger, finds somebody that's coming to pay for something that they legitimately purchased, this like a longsword. And as soon as the buyers come in to pick up the items that they legitimately paid for, they, you know, they shut the door, they turn the sign to say closed, and they just hack them to pieces.
Oh, my God. Oh, man. That is a chaotic group you got.
It's a very chaotic group. It's a very chaotic group.
Then they kept the sword, and they took the 750 gold pieces from on top of it.
They did. They did. And there's a little more about that in the next episode to come out. They'll talk about what they ended up doing with those people afterwards with the heads that they kept.
So and then at the end of the game, there's a lot of buying of virgins at a slave market or something. I'm not sure what's going on there. But they were debating for quite a while about injecting a tavern wench with mind erasing centipede poison to turn her into a virgin. So I came
awesome.
In. Yeah, I ended up. I liked it. I'm going to listen. I came for the Jeffrey, and I'm coming back for poisoned wenches.
You know, I Jeffrey, it sounds like you're glossing over a few of these details when you usually tell us about this group.
It's a very chaotic group. There's nothing that's expected, and they have some very grand schemes really getting into motion right now. So it's apt to be an interesting little time in their adventuring careers. But yeah, the virgins and the bar wenches were the temple that they took over. They need to resume sacrifices. They were trying to figure out how they're going to do that because they need to sacrifice for the next full moon, which is about 7 days game time. So that's where all that piece came in. And then the guy with the centipede poison was mad because he'd applied it to his weapon. Everybody disappeared. There's no one to hit. And he just felt like he had to use the centipede poison on somebody. So the dog was voted down and they decided to go for the bar wench walking home from work. And yes, the group is very chaotic.
Well, I liked it. Yeah, and it's over at irontavern.com/podcast. Podcast, yeah. I think.
Yep, 4/ podcast. That's it.
We'll definitely put a link to that in the show notes because we've been getting murdered with requests for a live play podcast. And Jeffrey, you stepped up and answered the call. Thank you, sir.
Yeah. And I think my group, too, they were real cool with it. One of the other guys is doing the recording, and then we pieced it together, and the rest of the group was cool with it getting put out in podcast format. So definitely a thanks to the group for, you know, putting up with me and recording and actually posting it live.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it tempered their play style any.
It did not. It did not. One of the guys from the group at the end says, I might not have said that one thing if I had known it was going to be published, but it's okay. So it's all good.
Lord, my group, we ran my system this past weekend, and as you know, we're running through the Great Stonehill Laser Massacre, and we had one of those games. I take it as a sign, Michael Curtis wrote the adventure, I just ran it, but I take it as a sign that Mike and I have done our job. When the game ended, they immediately got one of their friends on speakerphone to tell them what had happened in the game. So that's a pretty good sign, right?
That's awesome. A great sign.
But it was just sheer pandemonium. I mean, everything from a spell duel to laser fire to the deck of many things all happened in the same game.
Wow. That's awesome.
Did the Timbo J rear its tri-eyed head?
I'm gonna save the Timbo J for when they get back to their post-apocalyptic setting rather than insert him into Stonehell. But I'm definitely using that because that's an awesome creature. especially coming in threes and fours, like in a group of them. Okay, well, let's summon some emails.
You've got mail.
Message for you, son.
Summon email.
And the emails just keep on coming in. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, definitely. They do keep coming in. They just keep rolling right there.
Okay, so it looks like our first email is from William Brown. Hi, Spellburners. I am 12. My dad recently got DCC, and it's been a blast. He has run me through Sailors of the Starless Sea and Portal Under the Stars. I've really enjoyed the old-school alternative to Pathfinder. I've got three questions. Do you have any tips for the first-time judge? These are different enough. Yeah, maybe we'll do them one at a time because they're different enough. Scott, as our guest of honor, do you have any tips for the first-time judge?
And in terms of first-time judge for DCC?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, stay loose. Don't over-prepare for it. I mean, I think a lot of times people, when they first try to run a role-playing game, they tend to, like, kind of overdo the preparation. Just, you know, the preparation's there just to sort of ease through the uncomfortable moments, the silences and stuff. But, you know, stay loose, roll with it. The DCC is really great about giving you things to work with. So just let it do its thing and just kind of flow.
Good advice. Yeah, I'd say just don't worry too much about the rules if you're the first time at the table, because even our group played half the rules wrong when we sat down to play. The guy that was running it had never even run DCC before. He just read the book and jumped in. So make it up as you go. When in doubt, just stay consistent in your rulings.
Yeah, I think Scott and Jim summed it up pretty good. You know, over preparation, I think, is definitely a bane of a new game master or judge. Like I said, just roll with it. You know, listen to your players and go from there. And then rules can be intimidating. Don't let it be. Just, you know, if you don't know the rule at the table, don't lose 10, 15 minutes to try and look it up. Make a judgment call and go with it. Try to be consistent, or at least have in place the thing, you know, after the game, you'll spend the time to look it up and say, oh, I ruled that incorrectly. In the future, we'll do it this way. But don't lose time at the gaming table looking up esoteric rules or something. Just roll with it. What makes sense, and keep the flow going.
Yeah, just in closing to that, too, touching on what you guys already said, is don't be afraid to make mistakes. You know, not everybody knows all the rules, especially if it's a new system. You probably all make mistakes. Just move on. When you figure out the right way to do it, then, you know, adjust it from that point forward.
Yeah, William, the ages in our group went from 9 years old to 52 when we started playing. And one of the rules we missed was that you should get XP as you went through the character funnel. So as a result, our first five sessions were us just trying to get through Sailors of Starless Sea. So we were playing as wrong as you could play in that respect, and still had a blast. So no harm done. We all learned together.
Okay, so William continues. If you're running a funnel for only a few players, do you bump down the difficulty or hand out more PCs?
Hirelings.
Yeah, I've run funnels for as few as two and three players. So generally just four per player. I mean, much more than that just kind of overloads the players. So four per player is good enough. I mean, the body count stays consistent at about 50% no matter what.
Yeah, and I'm the same. I wouldn't go more than four characters per player. If that didn't fix the number correctly, then, you know, if you need to scale down just a little bit, that's a possibility. But I certainly wouldn't go over more than four characters per player, even in a small group.
I mean, a tiny thing in a character funnel, like just dropping a couple of three regular swords somewhere in front of the party, will make a huge difference.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Or a pile of pitchforks.
Yeah, right.
A pile of pitchforks.
Anything yeah. That's not a freaking 1d4, you know, hand trowel.
Oh, hand trowels do 1d4?
Or whatever it was.
Man, I got to get a hand trowel.
Okay, so William continues. Could you explain how familiars work? Because I found the core rule book a bit confusing.
You think maybe he just read the spell check results and didn't check the judge's rules for familiars in the back?
Maybe. I'm not sure.
It's a table and a pretty straight roll, right?
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward.
I mean, you get a spell check, so you know how strong the spell went off, and then you hit that table, and it's by alignment, and then a random die roll.
Yeah, maybe he thinks there's more to it or something.
Maybe coming from Pathfinder, he might think there's a little bit more to it.
I think the big thing would be just make sure that, you know, if you only were looking at the spell, be sure to look at the reference on page 316 to the Summoning of Familiar, where I think it gets into a little bit more, I don't know, a little more detail that would probably clear up most of it. Because this right goes over the familiar type, goes over the familiar trait. You know, I think that might help a little bit. I know if you just look at the Find Familiar spell and try to base all your knowledge on the familiar off of that, it could look pretty scarce. But I think if you get to the Judges section, page 316, it probably would help give it a little more step by step as you build your familiar up.
Did Crawl, the Crawl magazine, didn't they have like some familiars or something in one of their issues? Do you guys remember?
I don't remember, but that sounds like something that was in Crawl.
It sounds familiar. I couldn't tell you what issue. That does sound like
it would be great. I was thinking the same thing, Jim. So William continues, thanks. Keep up the good work. Judge Nick from Australia, good day. I don't know. Did we paste two emails together here?
Oh, I think William just goes by Judge Nick.
Oh, okay.
But let me teach you how to speak Australian better than that, Job. Okay, you know the word good?
Yeah.
And what do you see out of?
Eye.
There you go. Good eye.
Good eye. Okay.
There you go.
Nice. Well,
maybe Scott could work on your Transylvania, your Dracula accent here, too.
It wasn't too good, was it?
It sounded fine. It sounded probably better than mine.
Okay. Who's got the next email?
I've got the next one. And this one's from Marcelo Marcedu. He writes, hello, Spellburners. First of all, excuse me, but I'm not a native speaker. On page 42 of the DCC rulebook, it is written that the D die being rolled with the attack roll. If a warrior now has multiple attacks in a round, the D die result from the first attack of the round also applies to subsequent attacks in that round. If the D die with the first attack is a 3+, then any of the following successful attacks that round will also be successful mighty deeds of arms. When are they announced? And then he also adds in, will this also count for the Dwarven Shield attack? And how is your opinion on that? And he finishes with greetings from Germany and thank you for this great podcast, GM Korig.
Guten Tag, Korig. Thanks for writing and listening.
Yeah, we've gone international quite in this episode, particularly. The way I do it, and I don't know if it's right, but the way I do it is you sort of declare your D-die and what it's going to do with your attack, and you apply the bonus to the second one. But it's sort of in conjunction, hand in hand with what you declared as your deed, is how I sort of work it. So you get like sort of one cool thing to do with your deed die if you hit it, and it's not necessarily getting like two super cool things. It's sort of a combined thing, is how I usually play it.
That's pretty much how I do it too. I mean, you get the cool thing that you do, and then the deed die is just a bonus to attack and damage for every subsequent attack.
Which is pretty meaty in and of itself.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, when you hit it, you hit it.
Well, yeah.
I didn't understand his email because it said if the D die with the first attack is a 3+, then the following successful attacks will also be successful mighty deeds when they were announced. But I mean, that's not true. You roll your D die per attack.
My understanding is that you roll the D die once and it counts for all three attacks. Am I incorrect?
Usually the way we do it when we play is we don't do subsequent attack rolls. We'll just roll all the attack dice at once, one D die. So, you know, if you got D20 and a D16 and a D6 D die, you just roll all those dice. And that's how we do it. I haven't thought about the case of, you know, rolling one attack, then another attack, then another attack.
Oh, it says that round right there. Sorry, I totally was thinking he was talking about the next round. Sorry.
Yeah, I think the question was more, okay, I announced this mighty deed at arms for my broadsword, but I'm a dwarf and I also have my shield attack. Do I have to figure out a whole new crazy thing to do with my shield attack? And what I heard you guys say was you announce one mighty deed, and if you know you're a dwarf and it's the shield, it could include the shield, but you just get the one cool thing to do.
Yeah, that's pretty much how I do it.
Well, that's the consensus of this group, Korig. However, if you're running the game, it's your rules, your house. Okay, our next email is from Kelly Davis, and Kelly writes, this question is mainly for Jeffrey, who I know is running a long-standing DCC campaign. It's clear from your recent adventures that the party is reaching a new level in power and influence. How do you keep the game challenging without either causing a TPK or being overrun by spellburned magic and followers? Kelly, that's a very good question, and I'm interested in that answer. How do you do that, Jeffrey?
Well, I'm still learning myself a little bit. My characters in my campaign are now, most of them are 4th and 5th level, and I have commented that this is where things start to get very powerful. I've got players are starting to get fireball. I've seen multiple magic missiles thrown for 50-plus points of damage. So it's a different because, you know, there's not many of the bad guys in any of the adventures I've run that can take a magic missile off of the wizard if he's spellburned himself up a little bit. And sometimes if he's just lucky and gets a, you know, 19 or 20. So some of it's just you get used to it and your cool guy may get taken out. Now, one of my sessions, the guy had a magic shield up. The guy threw a 57-point magic missile, I think, and magic shield was up, so nothing happened. So, you know, the bad guys have their own little their tactics and things like that. The other thing that's happening in my game a lot right now is things that are impacting the characters without necessarily being a hit point or even poison thing. More, there's been a lot of role-playing recently. Joe mentioned the two guys that got knocked off at the wizard shop. Well, those were actually Thieves Guild members coming to collect a sword for a relatively high up Thieves Guild person. So there's a whole little thing where they were easily able to knock off those two people, but it's probably going to have some pretty severe repercussions from it because of who they were. So I think trying to play that angle is something that's becoming more of a component of our game now. As far as TPK, they're actually harder and harder to kill just from the standpoint of, you know, they've got 4 or 5 rounds to, you know, get healed before they die. You know, that's a fair amount of time for the cleric to get to them and pull off a healing spell or something like that. I think I'll start seeing the really big, powerful people probably another level or two. I feel like right now we're in this transition period where we're starting to go from these, they're starting to find themselves and find their pace right now. So I don't know. That's sort of how I'm handling it so far.
So in summation, with great power comes great responsibility, because I've listened closely and they're piling up more and more karma debt and more places in your campaign.
Yes, and that seems to be the phase we're at now. Yes, they're powerful, but they're starting to put things in motion that are bigger than any single character, because like you said, the karma debts, either with patrons, organizations within the city, favors owed, favors due. So I feel like we're in this period where we're sort of setting the stakes for a much more powerful, you know, it'll be less about the characters and more who's going to take over the Thieves Guild, or can they overthrow the current Thieves Guild? And we're moving almost more into that sort of thing than we are just straight up into the dungeon smash and bash. Now, we're still going to have some of that. Some of these things are going to involve cool things like that. But yeah, the karma build's going to start having some implications.
I can tell you've got a handle on it because your game reports sound strikingly like Adventures of Knights at the Dinner Table, which is Jolly Blackburn does an excellent job of depicting that back and forth between the DM and the group.
I mean, some of the things, some nights I sit down, I'm like, there's been, especially this has been true for the past 2 or 3 weeks, where I sit down at the table, I have a couple bullet points on an index card, and it's sort of like, where's the group going to take me tonight? Because I'm not real sure where they're going to take me. So like, we're in this real fluid part of the game, I think. I'm thinking 7th, 8th levels where we're going to start to really start, we'll be back to, I don't know, how powerful will things be and things like that. But we'll see. So far, it's been a session by session.
Now, when did you start feeding them virgins? what level did that come in?
That started in about 4th level. And that was just because they took over a temple that had a monthly sacrifice. And they decided they wanted to keep the guys of the temple. So they're using it as a money-making operation. So they're trying to draw in a congregation. And because the previous temple owners sacrificed a virgin, you know, once a month, they've decided they need to do that in order to keep the faith and keep that donations and coffers full so they can skim off the top.
Nice.
That's a great guys.
Yeah, no doubt.
I like these guys. I wouldn't want to meet them in a dark alley though.
No, certainly not. They are very brutal.
Okay. Was that all it for emails?
That's it.
Yep, that's it.
Let's get to our main deal and interview this guy. Let's go to Mighty Deeds.
Wait a second. I have an idea.
That's plenty for the both of us.
I move for no man.
Ow.
Mighty Deeds.
Well, Scott, again, welcome to the podcast. Just to start off, why don't you tell us how you got your start in gaming? What's your gaming pedigree?
Well, let's see. I started back in 1981 with Redbox Basic. I believe it's the Menstner version. We started with that, and then we had the Blue Box Basic. Back when I started, there was only like that kind of pinkish red box and the blue box.
You had the Molvay set then, right? The purple one with the green dragon on the front?
Yes. Because
81's about when I started, and that's the box I started, was the Molvay set.
That would be Molvay then,
yeah. Awesome Errol Otis cover.
Yes, yeah. It was Errol Otis.
Yep.
From there, you know, I played some Gamma World and Gangbusters and Boot Hill and Chill and Marvel, Phase Rip, and I just, you know, continually gaming. I took a couple hiatuses in the early 90s, and I played lots and lots of games.
Well, and this thing that you've just published, Transylvania Adventures, looks like it, I mean, it looks and reads like it's a product of a lot of love for that genre and years and years of work. What's the elevator pitch for Transylvania Adventures for our listeners who haven't even heard of it?
Well, it's a supplement for Dungeon Crawl Classics that sort of advances the time period into the late 19th century, 1899. It's sort of a reaction to a lot of the other games that have come out for that time period, which sort of focus on the pathos and the psychological toll of dealing with these creatures. Because in every Call of Cthulhu game I've been in, there's just been a moment where, you know, the group decides to go get, you know, pickaxes and shotguns and revolvers and then just go blasting things out all Quentin Tarantino style. And Transylvania Adventures just kind of skips straight to that part. Van Helsing never fails a sanity check, you know, NPCs do. So that's pretty much it.
And you started working on this in 2007, which was way before Dungeon Crawl Classics RPG came out. So can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, actually, it was a surprise to me that I'd been working on it for that long. I was actually going through some old notes. And early on, I had the basic ideas down, and I was just trying to decide things like, you know, what system. I think initially I was looking at Swords and Wizardry or Barbarians of Lemuria, that system from Beyond Belief Games. And then Joseph came out with Dungeon Crawl Classics, and, you know, reading what he was going to do with the Appendix N literature and creating a game based on his readings of those, you know, that was exactly what I wanted to do with Hammer Horror and, you know, Gothic Horror and the, you know, things like Tomb of Dracula, Marv Wolfman and all that. And yeah, I really resonated with me. So I just jumped on and hung on for dear life.
Well, did you ever come to the right podcast? Because you are now surrounded with people that have had that exact experience. And Daniel Bishop was just on the show, said almost exactly the same thing. He was working on some of the stuff he's been working on, looking for a system when DCC RPG came along. And all of us have just looked at that and said, this is brilliant, and decided to hang our hats on it.
Yes, it's really wonderful what he's done with it. And I think it's, I'm surprised it's flown under the radar, you know, because there's so many old school Renaissance or whatnot games, because it is so much better than a lot of the other games that I've, you know, played in that meme or so. Joseph's done a great job with it.
Hear, hear.
Harley too. I think Harley had something to do with it somewhere.
One of the things I noticed when I was reading it is that you really seem to have a very strong feel for Transylvania, the whole era. Was that an interest that you had prior to the game, or knowledge that you went out and researched and picked up because you decided you want to write a game in that era? Which sort of came first, the game that led to the research, or have you just always had a strong basis in like Transylvania lore and the era and the Hammer Horror films and things like that?
Well, I've always been familiar with the Hammer Horror, but as far as like knowing about the late 19th century and Transylvania, that came after the game. That's why, you know, 5 years, a good chunk of that was research, you know, and I got to talk to a couple of people who grew up in Transylvania, like the real Transylvania, and that was eye-opening. And I'm kind of sad that I had to break the book up into different books, but otherwise it would be like Star Blazer Adventures, you know, it'd be like 3,000 pages long. But, you know, the setting chapter and the hex map chapter will just show more how much research went into this thing. It's pretty huge.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I mean, just from the first one here, I mean, I could tell that, you know, that you really had, you know, you were in tune with Transylvania. It was impressive, and certainly showed, you know, a deep involvement with the game. So I was curious which one came first. Very cool.
So are you referring to the Hanging Judge's Guide to Transylvania and the Transylvanian Grimoire?
Yeah, originally it was just going to be one book. And then I realized that was going to be way too big. And then I split it into two books. And then towards the end, like about the middle of last year, I realized, you know, this is going to be like a 700 page book, and then followed by like a 300 page book. So I had to split them up.
I was just saying, so you mentioned that the in the book that there's monsters and spells. What are those two different books cover?
Well, the next book, Hanging Judge's Guide, and Daniel Bishop actually came up with that name, by the way. So. The Hanging Judge's Guide is going to have the hex map. It's a full hex map of Transylvania, and it's also going to have monsters. It's going to be a little bit of a different take from DCC on monsters. At Gen Con, Job, you guys fought the Transylvanian Adventures version of the werewolf, and things got pretty real. And that's pretty much how the monsters are. And then there's also a few more little rules in there, like some things that got pulled out of the first book. And then the third book is mostly the spells, the spell types. There's like regular DCC magic is more what I'm just calling quick cast spells. Then there's rituals like are in the first book, potions, and maybe a few little extra things that I've been working on. And the third book will also have setting hacks and different ways of playing the game, like a post-apocalyptic sort of Vampire Hunter D setting hack and things of that nature.
That sounds cool. So, you do mention new methods of spell casting. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you want to share about that, or is it still in development?
Well, I've done a lot of the research and a lot of the legwork around the math of the spell casting. One thing I know for sure that's going to be in there is potions, a sort of alchemy. I'm trying to work on a sort of an approach to gadgetry, like steampunkish type steamwork and clockworks and things like that. So trying to work those in, but that's a little tricky right now. But the theorist is the spellcasting class, has been around since like early drafts. And I've been, playtesting the theorist now since DCC came out, really. So it's an interesting little class. I would say the theorist is to the polymath what the scoundrel is to the valiant. So hopefully that'll give an idea.
Well, I want to talk about all that, but before we forget, I want to make sure we get the basic basis covered with where can the listeners get the supplement right now, and in what formats can they expect it to come in?
So right now it's available through RPG Now and DriveThruRPG, and I'm working on getting the print copies together through Lulu and also through RPG Now and DriveThruRPG. So the hardcover version should be available sometime early next month, and there's going to be a softcover version and a hardcover version available through Lulu.
I saw the picture you posted of your proof of the hardbound, and it's looked nice. It's about, but besides the fabulous Doug Kovacs cover, I mean, it's about the size of a typical hardbound core rule book.
Oh yeah, it's a pretty thick book, and Doug did an amazing job on the art, inside and outside. Got to give him props. He made it like look amazing.
Yeah, you're mentioned in the interior cover as being one of the interior artists.
Yes.
What pages can we see examples of your work on?
Well, there's some examples from the Winter Home that I did. There are a couple little Vampire Brides. I'd have to track them down. But the Starkweather Mountain map I did, and there's a little spider around in here somewhere that I did as well. I was hoping I'd have more time to do a little bit more art in there, but it didn't happen.
Believe me when I tell you, we understand. There's never enough time.
That's true.
How about we approach this by starting to talk through what it is and how it differs from the traditional DCC core rules? It's a supplement as published, mm-hmm. So you can now use the DCC game engine to roleplay Vampire Hunters in the late 19th century, very much the Hammerhar and even the old Universal Monsters. The first big rule change I saw was that there's a new ability or score called the Ruin Score.
Yes, the Ruin Score. So when I undertook this, I knew going into it, once I decided I was going to go with a level-based system that was OSR influenced, I'd have quite a few little sticking points. And the first one was armor. There's no armor. The second one was no healing magic, and there were others, but those were the two biggies.
Those are two. Those are big.
Yeah, I mean they're like fundamental to, you know, the traditional world's most popular fantasy role playing game. So ruin's the way that characters stay alive. A lot of times when people sit down to playtest or at a convention, they see this ruin score and they feel a little doubtful about it, but it's really keeping track of your get out of jail free cards. So one way to look at it is once you get up to like a ruin 3 or a ruin 4, you're kind of getting into trouble. And it's good because you can scale it up or down. It becomes a currency that the judge can use. So if the judge is going to do something really horrible to your character, he knows it's just terrible, horrible, bad. He's like, look, you can have a point of ruin back. And so that's kind of a fun thing, too.
How does it work exactly?
Oh, yes. So ruin starts out for leveled characters at 1. For 0 level characters, it starts out at 3. And so when you're dropped to 0 hit points, your character makes what's called a ruin roll, which is a luck skill check. So you roll a d20 and you add your luck modifier against whatever the judge rolls. He's going to roll a number of d6s equal to your ruin score. So you can see at ruin 1, it's negligible. Very rare that anyone fails it. But once you get up to 3 or 4, it gets a little hairy there. So it's an easy mechanic. It's pretty fun. It's not a death spiral. And people seem to like it. I actually have gone through several iterations of ways to keep characters alive, and this is just the one that seemed the most intuitive.
Is this how Job's character stayed alive at Gen Con as he continued to punch your shark?
Job actually gave me one of my most amazing stories of all time with Transylvania Adventures. He just dove into the water, swam up. Actually, first he took off his shirt. We got to say that because he had chiseled abs.
just like in real life.
Just like in real life. He took off his shirt, and I said that there was a shark because there's this huge prehistoric shark in the water. And meanwhile, Michael Curtis is watching us play Tower Out of Time, and he's saying, shark? Where's the shark come from? But anyway, so Job takes off his shirt, dives in the water. I asked him, are you getting in the boat? He's like, no, I'm swimming. So he swims out there. I'm saying, here comes a shark. And he's like, I punch it. And I'm like, you punch it? He's like, yeah, I'm going to punch it in the face. And I'm like, okay. And he rolls a 20. It was brilliant. It was a phenomenal moment. And crazy stuff like that happens a lot of times when I play this game at conventions and play test and with my group here as well.
I'm not sure I had connected it all together. Was this a were-shark roaming the waters of Transylvania?
No, at Gen Con, as a sort of like a special thing, I had the players write down something on an index card that they wanted to appear in the game.
Oh.
And the deal was, if I couldn't somehow fit it into the game, I was going to buy that person a drink. Fortunately, everyone at the table was above the age of 21. But, you know, I was able to hit all the things, including like shape changers, a epic finale with a werewolf, and what was it?
Flying monkeys.
And Nazi dirigibles. Yeah. So being able to fit all of that was just, it was pretty wild. And yeah, I'm not sure Michael Curtis quite understood what we were doing there.
I think I saw him shaking his head and walking away.
Oh no!
If Mike had been a player, his card would have said T-Rex. Bet me.
Oh, of course. We've actually had a zombie T-Rex in a Transylvania Adventures game. It was outside of Stonehell Dungeon. Don't ask me. I'm not sure. I'm not sure how that transpired.
I don't think any explanation is required.
Okay, and so that replaces recovering the body, right?
Yes, it does. Bleeding out and recovering the body. That you don't need them with ruin. Ruin, basically, you wind up missing your turn if you make the check. So you're up and at them the next round with 1d4 hit points.
And that also balances out the characters are not walking around in plate mail or chain mail.
Yeah, that's part of it. The other part of it is armor class is based on your character class.
Right.
So that's a big change, too.
I thought that was a good way to deal with the armor piece, though, because like you said, you can't really get much above leather in that era logically. So I thought it was an interesting way to get around the armor factor.
Yeah, and there's some mathematical considerations there as well. I mean, if you were to look at the grid of these classes based on all the things that make up a character, not considering their abilities, like their class abilities, you'd see that, you know, they all sort of line up to create a different experience for each one. like the exotic's kind of a glass jaw, you know. He'll put up like crazy amount of attacks per round, but you know, and he's got a really high AC, but once he gets hit, he's going to get hurt really bad.
I want to go through the character classes one at a time, but let's save that towards the end because I want to try and highlight all the shiny new rule mechanics.
Oh, sure.
So after adjustments based armor class adjustments based on class and the ruin score, you also have different hit point recovery rules.
Yeah. And actually those
no clerics, no meta packs, no healing potions.
Right. There are three primary ways that people get their hit points back. And one I always forget. At the end of every scene or encounter, anybody who's not at max hit points can recover 1d4 minus one hit point. So that means you can get anywhere from 0 to 3. And that kind of balances out with the general amount of hit point loss a DCC character can take on average. And then on top of that, there's also the stamina burn. Basically, it's where you can burn off a point of stamina and you get 1d6 plus your level. The Reaver, I think, gets 2d6 plus your level. And that actually is built in with its own sort of limiting factor in that the first time you use it, it costs 1 stamina point, the second time 2 stamina points, and the third time 3 stamina points, and just keeps going up and up until you start hitting a point of no return. And then the third way that you get it back is through heal others, which is it's sort of a wave to first aid slash healing potion in that it costs yay amount of gold to get 1d4 hit points back.
Gotcha. So and I don't mean this in a bad way, but it sounds a little 4E too.
It is a little bit 4E. I mean, there's some influences from, you know, some modernish systems here, not just fourth edition, but you know, some other influences from, you know, more narrative-y type of games.
In the course of some of the games you've run, has the stamina burn been something people have used frequently? How often do people use the stamina burn? It seemed interesting when I read it, but I was just curious how often people were trying that route with it. Because you could use that one even during a combat, right?
Yeah, you can use it at any point in time. The answer is not very much. First off, DCC characters are pretty low on the attribute scores, and stamina takes a beating anyway. You'll see people use it once or twice, but it's been very rare that I've seen people go and use it 3 times in an adventure. People in Transylvania Adventures tend to get dropped pretty quickly, so a lot of times they don't see it coming.
So it's a last recourse kind of healing.
Yeah, it's not something people would want to do a lot.
And luck operates a little differently in Transylvania Adventures.
Yeah, that was a mathematical consideration around the difference between, say, a +1 on like a spell check versus a +1 on a to hit. Some things don't really even out. And so you burn a point of luck for saves, attack rolls, and skill checks. You get a 1d4, +1d4 instead of a +1. And everything else is just a +1.
So with just attack, saves, and skills, but not with spell casting, because that would counter what you just were trying to do.
Exactly. Got it.
Okay, that makes more sense now that you've explained it that way.
Everybody's
wondering, I'm trying to figure out, was this attack, saves, and skills? I'm like, okay, I'm trying to figure out why it makes more sense when you say, you know, versus a spell check roll or something like that, why you'd go to something like that. It's cool.
Yeah, it's just sort of one of those things. Like one of the issues I had at the table when I was playtesting this was people complaining that, man, 1 point of luck isn't worth anything, you know, it's just a +1. So, and it was only in certain circumstances. So I tried a few different approaches, and this is the one that sort of worked out the best.
I've got it, because depending on how you roll, 1 point of luck could change it from a hit to no hit in melee, but on a spell check, it could change it from 4d4 to 6d8.
Exactly. Yeah. And also, I mean, you could also change it from, you know, you lost that spell to, you know, I mean, it's just there should be more expense associated with spellcasting.
So would it be fair to say that the most, I mean, because there's a pretty good bolus of fundamental rule surgery going on here compared to Dungeon Crawl Classics, would it be fair to say that this is just all about the game balance in the difference in the setting?
Mostly the difference in the setting. I wouldn't say so much game balance. I mean, there's some balancing in there, but it's not balance at the sake of fun, you know. I wanted it to be really fun to play, and this thing's gone through years and years of playtesting. So
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, Van Helsing was all great, but if you dropped in the middle of Sailors of the Starless Seas, he wouldn't last 5 minutes.
He'd be dead.
Yeah, quickly.
But yeah, but you know, if he's like a second level polymath, he'll be doing all right. I mean, the characters aren't as powerful as DCC characters can be, but they're still pretty fun.
You added an additional saving throw, a fear save to the game. What was the why added an additional saving throw? What made it fit better for Transylvania than just sort of piggybacking on something else that was already there?
I felt we needed something to do with intelligence. You know, intelligence is, there's a lot that intelligence does in DCC, but as far as like saving throws, you know, it was logical to put it with fear. And the fear save essentially takes the place of surprise. If you think about like rolling surprise in old D&D, it's, you know, 2 in 6, or some characters got a 1 in 6 chance, and that never really improved with level. Well, in Transylvania Adventures, it does. You know, you get better fear save, and the fear save doesn't come up very much. It's usually only when it seems called for. I think the last time I ran a Transylvania Adventures game, we had 1 fear save.
And similar to that, can you explain how you can die of fright?
Oh, dying of fright. well, some of that, well, you get, what happens is you get frozen with fear. So essentially that means that you're just freaking out. Like in the Conan stories, when Conan's up in the Tower of the Elephant and then he sees the giant spider and he's like, so you're having the moment there. And in the Hanging Judge's Guide with the monsters, they can really mess you up if you're frozen with fear in various ways.
So it's almost like being knocked prone and making yourself open to a coup de grace or something.
It can be, but they can also do some things like a vampire can use suggestion on you if you're frozen in fear, stuff like that. They get little benefits that against characters. And the next round, you know, you basically lose your turn. It's almost like surprise in that, you know, you don't do anything. The monsters do something. And if you want to, you can make another fear save. You know, sometimes you just have a bad roll. You just rolled a 3 and all you needed was an 8. Okay, that's cool. Or you can essentially intelligence burn and take a point of intelligence damage, temporary, not permanent, and then you're fine. You don't have to roll another fear save. So, and it can continue going like that. I did have one player in my local group who failed, I think, 3 fear saves in a row, and boy, he was just mad because he just couldn't roll above a 4 to save his life.
We've all had those nights.
It depends on which side of the GM screen I'm on. Behind the screen, I roll great. Well, we're almost down to the actual player classes. The section of the book that I enjoyed reading were the level 0 occupations, which were much crunchier than they are in DCC RPG. Because DCC RPG did a thing where, you know, you get your occupation, a couple of implements that come from it. And later on, if it comes up in an adventure, and they wrote it into a couple of modules that, you know, being a pie maker is somehow a benefit, you get to do things. But your level 0 occupations have all kinds of little stats that the characters can use later.
Yeah, probably the most important one is wealth. And that was just like, you know, the Transylvania Adventures isn't going to be a game where people are going into tombs and unearthing tons and tons of treasure. That's just not, it's not part of the fiction. It's not really part of the genre. So we gave them wealth, and wealth can be kind of fun. You don't want to be penniless or poor. If you had a chance to look at the in-between adventures tables, nobody wants to be eating gruel, because that's a terrible table where like one of the best results is you've found a mangy dog and have a new dog. That's about the best you can hope for.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, 19th century, you're already in the Industrial Revolution. It sucks to be poor.
Right. But, you know, I tried to keep it pretty close to DCC. It goes over literacy, has the same sort of trade goods as DCC. And languages is just one of those things. The second book has a better treatment of languages, in my opinion, because it's more broad. But I just didn't have space to put like all the rules in.
So one of the other things you changed in Transylvania Adventures was the dice chain. You removed the 5 and 7?
Yes, the 5 and the 7.
What were some of the reasons behind removing that out of the dice chain?
Well, it's kind of hard to create a mathematical model for something like a dice chain. But when you go from D20, and I actually have a D18 now, but it rarely gets used. But when you go from D20 to D16 to D14, 12, 10, 8, and then you go to 7, 6, 5, the 7 and the 5 wind up, instead of being like a minus 1 penalty, they're more closely a minus 1/2 penalty. And I just thought it was just easier all around to just keep them on the evens all the way down to the 3, of course. But, you know, there was just a math consideration there.
You've brought up math a lot. Do you have a professional background?
No, I work in software, but, you know, I did a lot of hacking around at this, and I was one of the playtesters for DCC as well. So, yeah, so I just tried my best to do what we found fun when we were playing the game.
I personally love it. It's because to me, it's all about, you know, moving the bell curve exactly where you want it.
Yeah, and that was part of it. I mean, the games with Transylvania Adventures are always very, very tense. One thing that also Transylvania Adventures has done is it's lowered the hit dice. I mean, if you're to look at the grid, like the Reaver, I believe, has a D12 hit die, but most all the rest of them have like D8s and D6s, no D4s, maybe the exotic. The Theorist has a D4. But the intent is, you know, to make a very panicky sort of game, and it is a state of panic. You know, I had a play tester here in Austin, and she said the game is like every time you go into something, you feel like this is the time you're going to die because you just know it's going to happen, but somehow you get through and then you're on to the next room and you do it all over again. And that's kind of fun because it's frightening and scary and tense without, you know, forcing people to go crazy.
Well, on such things, all drama and gameplay hinge, right?
Oh, yeah. And it was pretty funny in a North Texas RPG Con. I was playing a game with Harley Stroh and Doug Kovacs. And we dropped the players into, and Paul Wolf was actually in this game. And we dropped the players into Transylvania for just really one room. And man, they freaked out. It was hilarious. One player actually killed another player, beating a vampire to death with a torch. And it was pretty tense. They really lost it. But, you know, that's just kind of how the games come out. I mean, maybe Job can highlight that, too. I mean, it got pretty crazy. You know, people just do wild things.
Well, let's do the character classes now, because they're all different from anything anyone would be used to in fantasy RPG. So let's try and go through them one at a time and describe them and compare and contrast to traditional character classes in DCC where appropriate.
Sure.
First up, you got like the Valiant. How would you tell us a little bit about the Valiant character class?
The Valiant is the everyman or the every girl character class. It's the Luke Skywalker in Star Wars A New Hope class. You know, it's I'm the farm boy, tanned and attractive, and you know, I'm going to go fight the forces of darkness with, you know, my chiseled abs and a sense of bravery and overdeveloped sense of confidence almost. So it's akin to the halfling in that if you were going to merge DCC character classes with Transylvania Adventures character classes, you might want to either make a Valiant a halfling or get rid of the Valiant and just use the halfling. But there are similarities there, but the Valiant is much less useful in combat.
I know some of the character classes had different things with luck. Was Valiant one of the ones that had a luck difference, how they spent luck?
Yes, the Valiant has a luck die, similar to what the Thief and the Halfling get in DCC.
Okay.
The Valiant is also the one that's very social. The Valiant could start with an animal companion or a human companion in lieu of taking a bonus to the skill. So, you know, the Valiant it spends and gives luck a lot like the Halfling does. There's some slight adjustments, but a different class, of course, but it's same, similar sort of mechanic to how they use luck.
Okay, and as presented in the rules, next up would be the Exotic.
Yes, have you guys seen the movie Brotherhood of the Wolf?
I have not.
I've seen Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS.
Yes, I've actually seen that myself. So, yes. Yeah, well, the Exotic is not Ilsa. Now, the Exotic is sort of this kung fu fighting foreigner from a strange land. If you think like Tonto from the Lone Ranger with nunchucks, you know.
So, Morgan Freeman and Robin Hood.
Yes, very much so. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I had to make the exotic very general. So if you look at the exotic weapons, there's pretty broad range of exotic weapons that the exotic can take from different cultures. Yeah, it's just the kung fu fighting. I mentioned earlier, it's the glass jaw, high armor class, low hit points, so-so saves. And the one thing different about the exotic is when the exotic uses mighty deeds, the bonus only applies to the attack, not the damage. That's a tricky sticking point sometimes, you know, fits in with how they fight.
Gotcha.
So pretty much hit a lot, but not necessarily a bunch of bonus damage on top of that when they fight.
Exactly. The exotic is generally the class that uses two weapon fighting the most, because they're always considered to have two weapon due to unarmed combat.
Right. Okay. That's where my love of the dice and the math, like you were talking about, comes in, because I realized one day that the halfling, dual wielding halfling, is only attacking on a D16, so he's not going to hit it as often, but he's going to crit about 10% of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think next up we have the half-breed.
The half-breed's very popular on the interwebs. The half-breed is a very general half-something character class. It's basically a racial character class. It could be half werewolf, half fairy, half demon, half angel, half vampire. Most people like the half vampire. I did have one character who was playing a half breed with the vampire trait, and in a drunken stupor, gnawed up one of the other characters, and that was a fun night. But yeah, the half breed gets a choice of, you know, like two what they're called dark gifts, or a dark gift and two weapon fighting, and they do damage like a thief, but they are very much sort of this or that. I've had some players play a half-breed character where they didn't really know what they were half of, which is always fun. And it's set up where you can just randomly determine what your dark gift is, you know. So that's a nice little twist on that character class. But they could also, like, if you wanted, say, elves. Well, if I were doing like using these classes in a fantasy context, I'd probably make the exotic an elf. But if you wanted to do like some strange race, like, you know, I think they call them the demon kin or tieflings or whatever, then you could use the half breed for that.
So a little like Sookie Stackhouse in True Blood. You know, you read minds, but you don't necessarily know you're half fairy.
Yes, actually, there is sort of a Sookie Stackhouse gift in there towards the end of that section, very much so, and ranges from Sookie Stackhouse to Blade. So,
oh, nice.
So, I mean, it's very, very general.
That's a nice spread from Anna Paquin all the way to Wesley Snipes.
No doubt.
And we also have the Hunter class. I assume this is sort of more like the Van Helsing class, or no?
Yes, actually, it is inspired by Peter Cushing's portrayal of Dr. Van Helsing.
Nice.
So if you're familiar with Peter Cushing, it's a pretty fun little class. It's more of a general fighter class, and has a nice little ability called Prepared for Anything, which allows you to pull, like, what was it? Last time it was used in one game, guy pulled a silver crucifix out of his boot. So, you know, and it's kind of fun. It's a fun class.
This sounds like a game where that could come in handy.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Like having a wooden stake up your sleeve, or a crucifix, or a silver chain, or an extra bullet in the chamber, something like that.
Oh, wait. I've got some garlic in my pocket here somewhere. Hang on.
Exactly.
And the polymath.
Yes. The polymath is the ritual magic user, pretty much. It's based off of Van Helsing as portrayed in the books, in Bram Stoker's Dracula and stuff. He's the turn unholy master, you know. He does turning like nobody else. And he's also kind of the Sherlock of the classes, in that he has an ability called Elementary. And it can be used like in a general sense, but it can also be used in a sort of directorial or authorial sense, in that, you know, I had one player who would, you know, invent clues, you know, oh, hey, I know that this guy did da 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 and is involved with, you know, the organized crime lords of blah blah blah, you know, and I just assign a difficulty to that, and he rolls it. If he beats the roll, it's what it is. If not, then I get to modify it a little bit. So you can do a lot of fun things with a polymath.
That's a good question about that, because in the fiction, that's always the character who always knows what's going on, that none of the protagonists ever listen to or take their advice. Does it play that way? I mean, do other player characters go, nah, we're just going to go kill it, and then die horribly anyway?
Generally not. Generally not. I mean, I've had some situations where the players have just been like, yeah, whatever, and they go out, but then they get stomped on and they're like, oh, hey, wait. I mean, they have to back away a little bit and regroup, and they're like, oh, we need, you know, we can't just go in there and beat things to death. We have to think about it.
Gotcha.
So the Reaver looks like we got next.
Yes, the Reaver is he's a tank. It's a very general fighter class. So if you don't like Mighty Deeds and you want to play a fighter, just play a Reaver. The Reaver was added in because in early playtests, he didn't exist, but there was a desire to have a class that was just, I swing it and I hit it. And that's pretty much the Reaver. And his game is one of attrition. He has a terribly low armor class, very middling damage production, but extremely high hit points. So the Reaver is the one you drop in the middle of like 50 opponents and you just kind of sit back and watch. I had a Reaver take out like, what was it, 4 monsters in like 1 round. And, you know, here come 8 more. So if that's the kind of class you like to play, then the Reaver is right up your alley.
Gotcha. The Scoundrel sounds like that's probably the character class for a character named Igor.
maybe the Scoundrel is like a cross between Wesley from The Princess Bride and Inigo Montoya. You know, the Scoundrel is a fun class for people who want to really ruin the judge's day. It's because the Scoundrel has, you know, an ability or two that'll let him, you know, like I had a Scoundrel up against the wall and I was like, all right, cool, you failed your save. And then he pulled out, you know, his free 20 and then he was like, nope, I made it. And it's like, oh man, you know, so Scoundrels get their own chance to rewrite history there.
That TPK, it doesn't mean what I think you think it means.
Exactly. The scoundrel's the only one left standing after the TPK.
Gotcha.
And finally, we've got the Survivor.
The Survivor. So are you guys familiar with the comic League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
Oh, yeah, of course.
The Survivor's Mina. That's Mina Harker is the inspiration for the Survivor.
Oh, sweet.
So the Survivor has survived some traumatic experience with a supernatural creature in his or her past and is just pretty much really hard to kill.
So she got out of a Harley Stroh adventure alive and in one piece.
Exactly. The Survivor's very hard to scare and very hard to keep down. So that's another interesting little class. And it's a good one for people as well who want to play a fighter type class, but don't really gel with the Mighty Deeds. Not that Mighty Deeds aren't cool, but some of the playtesters that I've had have been like, well, I don't want to think about it. I just want the bonus. So,
yep. Around where I play, we call those lazy players.
Oh, yeah. Well, lazy players can be fun too, though.
See, you're so nice and I'm so harsh. Sorry. I didn't mean to harsh or laid back there. Sorry, Scott.
Oh, no, that's all good. One of the things that I wanted to mention about the classes is when they were being thought up, initially I thought I would just do like traditional D&D classes, right? So like fighter, fighting man, wizard, cleric-ish type person, and no thief, because the thief is where everything started to go awry. Basically split all these classes up. Now, the wizard's to come later, that's the theorist, but these classes are all split up as like different variations of fighting man. It's one way to think of it. And if you look at it, the thief skills are spread out across the entire group. So there's no one single thief that has all these little nifty tricks. And you can kind of mix and match your own character to be just whatever you want it to be based on, you know, skills and all that. And these are more like the DCC skills than like third edition or something. So, and then there's the multi-classing, which can be pretty cool. Because everything was put together like on this grid where, you know, the characters play out a certain way, the abilities are almost just add-ons and pretty interchangeable. So I've had like hunters that maybe didn't have prepared for anything but had unarmed fighting or an exotic weapon. And, you know, I've had polymaths that maybe didn't have turn unholy, but had prepared for anything, you know, so you can just sort of smorgasbord it out and just create some really interesting combinations of classes.
That was one thing that struck me when I read the classes is I was like, I don't know what the hell any of these classes are. This is something new and interesting. You know, it really kind of
you know, spurred me on to go through and read all through them.
Well, they started out differently. Like traditionally in the world's most popular fantasy role-playing game, the classes are based on combat roles.
Scott, you can go ahead and say it. It's DCCRPG.
Yeah, no, nobody from WotC, nobody from WotC listens to this podcast. We tested that.
Cool. Well, traditionally, if you go back to like the 70s, and I was one of these kids, you know, playing like Gettysburg and the War Games and like these, you know, little game shops. And then out of that spurred, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, and, you know, you've got the artillery and the infantry and the medic. And so that all makes sense, except for, of course, the thief. So, and Transylvanian Adventures, early on, I decided to split from that and make genre-based classes. So that's why, I mean, like, you can name characters that these classes are based out of instead of, like, combat roles. So, like, you know, the hunter, you know, the polymath, Sherlock Holmes or Dr. Van Helsing, you know, that sort of thing. So I think that that's a big difference, because you could take these character classes and without any really rule changes at all, you could run, like, sword and sorcery or steampunk or, you know, a variety of different genres with the same character classes verbatim.
That's completely legit. And I think that's basically the way they did it back in the day. I can't remember which podcast I interviewed who on, but somebody, Tim Kask or somebody, was like, John Peterson was a guest on Save or Die. And I mentioned that I played my first elf ever back in the day, just like Elric of Melbourne. And he's like, that's exactly what the elf class was based on. So there's a tradition of that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you've put like a monstrous amount of work into this. See what I did there? So Joe put this into the notes very kindly, and I'm sure our listeners want to know, but I'm asking for my own benefit as well. What advice would you give to those that are going, okay, I want to do this. I want to write a setting or a supplement for whatever game, hopefully DCC.
It's a lot of work. It's probably more work than most people think it is.
Well, you've ticked one of my boxes immediately by have a passion for what you're writing about. Don't decide I want to write a adventure module. You know, find something you're passionate about and then write that into it.
Yeah, and that was the thing. Like early on, people were wanting me to do a Kickstarter, but, you know, I didn't. And one of the reasons was I was going to do this anyway because it's the game about this genre that I always wanted. It's Hammer Horror as I've wanted to play it in a role-playing game.
Right on.
And I didn't know if I could take it if my Kickstarter wasn't funded, and it broke my heart and I still did it anyway. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So yeah, totally. Definitely got to have a passion for it. And also the playtesting, you know, I went through a lot of playtesting with this. It's gone through 6 rewrites, 4 of them very major, involving, you know, over 70% of it rewritten altogether based on playtest. And like, oh, this doesn't work. Oh, that doesn't work. And if you had the alpha or the beta, you'll see how the classes have evolved over time. They got simpler. They got more focused. They got more streamlined. That's something too. You know, you got to be willing to revise and try to stay focused on making something true to what you want. But it also has to be fun. You know, it's got to be something people want to play.
Now, when you were working with Joseph Goodman, did he give you any input that ended up making its way into the book eventually? Or?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Especially early on, Joseph was really good, giving me some input on like the alpha version. And that was, you know, the spurred on, like, I think the second rewrite. And yeah, I mean, you know, I've been part of dozen or more playtests of different games. And, you know, most game companies don't rewrite the whole game because of playtest feedback. But, well, you know,
I mean, you want to talk about passion for a system and a company. That's what I've got for Joseph Goodman and this game, because this, I think, is as much like being a teenager in 1974 and living in Lake Geneva could have possibly been, because they're,
oh yes,
I mean, Harley and Michael and Joseph and Job. And I mean, the whole community is so open and helpful and friendly. It's like a real passion project for everybody involved.
Oh, for sure. And like, you know, going to that rewrite thing, you know, Joseph did rewrite a good chunk of the beta based on playtest feedback. He was very open, in fact, more open than any other writer or publisher I've ever been in, you know, associated with in terms of a playtest. He was really super awesome with that. But yeah, Harley, Michael Curtis, talking with you at Gen Con, Jem, and also Job. There's Daniel Bishop, Doug, Paul Wolf, I mean, just a ton of people just stepped up and were very open with feedback and what I could expect. And just they were all really awesome and all had a hand in sort of spurring this on and making it what it is.
Yeah, I mean, I know all those guys and I'm not anything special. I met Michael Curtis just because I was heading into town at GaryCon on a smoke run. And this guy walks up and says, "Will you get me a carton of cigarettes?" And I said, "Sure." That's how I met Mike. Next thing you know, I'm sucked into Dungeon Crawl Classics RPG.
Well, here's how I met Mike. I was like sitting across the table from him at North Texas, and he was about to run. He was about to run a game that I'd signed up for, and I was like, "Are you Michael Curtis?" And he's like, "Yeah." And I was like, "You wrote Realms of Crawling Chaos?" He's like, "Uh huh." Stonehell Dungeon, uh huh. And I just started listing off all these things that I'd read and played and stuff that he'd written, and I'm sure he thought I was a crazy stalker person, but I was just so stoked. Just, you know, this is Michael Curtis. I did the same thing with Harley too. So who knows? I'm sorry. I went a little fanboy on them.
Oh, dude. I met Jim Ward when we were doing a deal to publish a version of Metamorphosis Alpha. And before I drove to Lake Elkhorn, Wisconsin from Cincinnati to meet him. And I'm like, okay, I need 15 minutes of being a fanboy before we talk business. Will you sign my Metamorphosis Alpha?
See, you were much better than I was. I didn't give them any advance notice.
Well, Scott, thank you for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
The show's not over, so stick around. We're going to open it up to our Dungeon Denizens listener contest.
Go on, boss. Chop his head off.
Right, silly little speeder.
Jesus Christ!
I warned you.
My armor is like tenfold shields. My teeth are like swords. My claws...
Okay, it's our second episode with a Dungeon Denizens winner. Who have we got this week, guys?
This week, after looking at our entries in the that have been submitted so far, this one came from Darren Bolton, and he presented us with the Bone Thicket.
I like the name already.
Yeah, the name alone I thought was a good one. Let's see, the Bone Thicket. Let me read the description, and let's see, the Bone Thicket. Thick, gnarled branches jut out of a twisted, aged trunk with entangling roots reaching out to all directions from the base of the Bone Thicket. Bones of all shapes and sizes lie scattered all around the base of the tree as the contorted roots stripped the flesh from the bones. Bone Thickets move slowly through the woods, searching for flesh to consume. They like collecting the bones of their victims around the base of their trunk, letting the roots slowly erode bones and flesh into the earth around it. Witches commonly make packs with Bone Thickets to protect their cairns, promising bones and blood. One of their special abilities is Gnarled Roots, where everyone in a radius of 30 feet makes a reflex save each round. Depending on how badly they fail, they become entangled and or pulled for one round. A DC 11 equals entangled. DC 5 entangled and pulled 10 feet towards Bone Thicket. Bone Thickets are made of wood and therefore vulnerable to fire, so Bone Thickets take double damage from fire. They're a 3-hit dice creature, slow moving at 10 feet. They do get 2 action dice. Like I said, they have the special power of Gnarled Roots, and then, of course, they're vulnerable to fire. And so that one's submitted to us by, again, Darren Bolton. And that's the one that wins Dungeon Denizens for the week.
Man, that's pretty Evil Dead DCC monster right there.
It is. It is. I like that one.
Yeah, I could definitely, awesome. I could definitely see that one, you know, protecting the wood shrine of the Bloodfather.
Yes, nice. Yes.
In your system, Job, that Bone Thicket would have lots of little glints of gold, because that's how you trick the players.
Oh, yeah.
Bones and a nice sword. Go get it.
Is it shiny and well-crafted?
Oh, it's got jewels. And Job's
your nice.
No, nowhere around Jeffrey's players, though. Jesus.
Those guys could get a curse where Bone Thickets grow out their skulls, and they think that's cool.
Oh, nice, nice.
Well, thanks, Darren. You are the winner this week, and when this podcast is released, your creature will appear on our website under Dungeon Denizens, and you win all the bragging rights therein.
Yeah, thanks for writing in, and keep those Dungeon Denizens coming. We'll keep looking at them.
Are you going to drop the picture for this one, Jim?
Of course, unless somebody else wants to do it.
No, I can't compete with you, man. Timbo J, it was awesome.
Well, thank you. As long as we're all clear, I'm not a fantasy illustrator, just a cartoonist. I do my best.
Ah, it's good stuff. Don't do that.
I am no Doug Kovacs. If we could afford him, I'd have him do everything.
I would too.
And if he said he was too busy, I'd go get Peter Mullen.
If he said he was too busy, I would go take out the people who were keeping him busy.
My sense of Doug is he can take care of himself.
Oh, no, I wouldn't take him out. I'd take out the people who are keeping him busy.
Okay, well, I think that's going to... Oh, no, we've got to do Patron Bond. Let's do that next.
Who are you?
Your new lord and master.
What orders from Mordo, my lord?
Oh, don't trouble. One thing I can't stand, it's people groveling.
Go ahead.
Patron Bond.
This is the section of the show where we rate whatever it is we've been talking about. And the tricky bit about this is when we have a guest on, we're rating their product while they're in the room with us listening, instead of like chickens where they just have to listen to the podcast later.
Nice.
So we get to practice. Never rate anything behind their back you wouldn't rate to their face, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so Transylvania Adventures. We've all got this, and I'll tell you up front, regardless of the rating, the second it's available in hardback, I'm getting that too. So hurry up.
I will.
Okay. So what do we think? Critical hit, a miss, or a fumble?
Well, I guess I'll jump in there first. I definitely give it a critical hit with some reservations. You know, it's a supplement for DCC, so it's definitely a system that's got a little bit more crunch than DCC. So if what really attracts you to DCC is the simplicity of the rules, then you might have a hard time with the rule set at first. But if you like DCC and you know some tight mechanics that Scott worked in here, and of course you know want to explore the setting and the genre, the horror elements, which I think just are done really well, then definitely check this one out.
Okay, I'm going to jump in and go with a hit, and the only reason I'm not going with critical hit is probably just because I haven't gotten a chance to play it yet. I'm having a hard time wrapping my brain around some of the rule changes, but I want to see the other two-thirds of the game with the monsters and spells. Scott, I'm sorry, I'm like chronic magic user wizard player, so I want spells. But
you want the aetherist?
Yes,
it's
someone.
All good.
I want some way to break the adventure in my character's hands. No, just kidding. No, not really. but a solid hit, and that's provisional. I could upgrade that to critical hit later. Next con we're all at, I want to play this.
For sure.
I didn't get to punch a shark because I think that night I was like tired and left the bar before the game started.
And I would give it a hit as well. Definitely a solid hit. The Job sort of mentioned the crunchiness. I think that's probably what sort of detracts slightly from me. There's a lot of rules. I think they're well thought out rules, especially after, you know, speaking to Scott tonight. I think there's great explanations behind every single, you know, tweak of the rule that's in there. So I think that shows a lot of research and a lot of thought was put into it, and they're very deliberate rule changes. Just a little bit on the crunchy side. Love the flavor in it. If you're going to do a horror genre, this looks like a great system to do it with. Definitely like that. I would definitely like to play this game at some point. Definitely sign me up at a con if we cross paths at the same con. I'd definitely like to play it. You know, sometimes when you actually play a game, they turn a little different. So, you know, I could see myself bumping up to a critical hit. But on a read-through, I'd go hit. But like I said, you can tell there's a lot of passion in this game. Well-written. Just a little too much on the crunchy side for me. But other than that, it's a solid hit.
I totally want to play it because now that we've interviewed you, Scott, I'm completely intrigued by, I mean, on a reading, I'm like, well, why was this changed? What's this for? But now having talked with you about it, I'm completely intrigued by the math behind some of the rule changes and modifications. That makes me want to play it. And that's coming from a guy who's never played Call of Cthulhu and has no desire to. But this sounds like something I want to try.
And I definitely agree. The read through, you know, I'm like, why was this changed? But over the course of speaking with you tonight, so much of it makes, I'm like, ah, okay, I see why you changed that. And it makes sense. So I think that's good that it's not just arbitrary, you know, additions or changes. It shows a lot of thought behind the changes. So I think that's a good sign.
Oh, yeah. And that's all fair. I mean, I think it probably reads a little crunchier than it is when we play it. So for sure, when we're at a con, we'll get together and we'll play it. I've been asked to keep it down at like three events so far because it gets so rowdy and crazy. And it, I don't think that translates in the text so much outside of my copious use of the word gothic ass kicking horror. But but yeah, definitely when we're at the next con, I'll definitely be at North Texas. So if you guys are out there, we'll grab a room, hopefully away from, you know, prying ears that are going to complain and ask us to be quiet, and we can go just tear it up.
Oh, screw that. Let's tear it up in the foyer and get the cops called on us.
I was actually at a free RPG day here in Austin, and we were running a game. We ran Starkweather Mountain and then followed that up with, I think it was Cezricon the Mad, using Transylvania Adventures characters. And the same day they were having a Pokemon tournament. And they asked us to please be quiet because we were scaring the little kids. And that was a pretty epic moment right there. Yeah.
You're getting on my favorite subject, Scott.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Job loves to terrorize the kids. It's a passion for him.
Yeah, I'm already planning out my actual play podcast where, you know, I brutally murder my kids over and over, all their characters, and make them cry. And I'll start out the show with, you know, the Dead Kennedys, I Kill Children as my theme song. It's going to be great.
Jiminy Christmas. So you're going to be at North Texas Con, which I will definitely be at. Are you going to make it to Gary Con?
I don't know. I'll have to see. It's mostly, you know, work and getting up money to get to the conventions and all.
Gotcha. Well, thank you very much for being on the show, sir, and please come back.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime. Yeah. Thanks, Scott. It was awesome.
Thanks, guys.
Well, that's going to wrap it up for another Spell Burn. Remember, never split the party unless the party's already split, especially in Transylvania.
Good night, everyone.
Bye, everybody. Bye, Scott.
Bye. Good night.
The Spellburn Podcast is a production of Wild Games Productions in association with D20Radio.com. The Spellburn theme music is provided by the band Glitter Wizard. You can find them at glitterwizard.bandcamp.com. Promotional consideration for this podcast was provided by the Transylvania Tourist Bureau and the Reanimator Society. Visit sunny Transylvania and bring a rosy-cheeked friend or two. Or three. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Spellburn.